This is a friendly trigger warning. This story contains aspects of loss in pregnancy and motherhood. Please make sure you listen to this at a time that is right for you. You're listening to Franny & Co. The Podcast, a podcast for women wanting connection and inspiration in other women's stories. This podcast is all about how we navigate our way to motherhood and beyond. I'm your host, Franny, aka Francesca, of Franny & Co., founder of Care Club, the online group for mums and women. I run online courses and workshops designed to help women find the very best versions of themselves. I'm also a mother of four, raising three little kiddos here in Toronto. This week, I talked to Felicity. I spoke to her on the 15th of October, which was International Wave of Light, which means it's the Pregnancy and Infant Loss Awareness Day, where we light candles for the babies and pregnancies that are lost. Thank you, Felicity, for speaking to me on such a heavy day. I know it was an emotional chat, and I know it was a difficult conversation for you, and also for me to bear witness to that heaviness. A bit of a trigger warning for anyone who has suffered with postpartum depression and or pregnancy and infant loss. Maybe choose when this is a good time for you to listen to. And yeah, thank you so much, Felicity, for sharing and sharing so much of your journey and sharing so much honesty and truth in what has been a difficult journey for you. I thoroughly enjoyed this conversation. It's been a long time in the making, and we've really connected here on Instagram and my platforms for a while now, as well as connecting in real life a few times. You've been such a support in my journey and a real cheerleader for me and other people in the community. So I can't thank you enough for being brave enough to really bear everything in this conversation and still with a smile on your face. So thank you for all that you do. And I hope everybody enjoys this conversation.
Thank you for joining me, because I feel like this is like an intense day. We're recording on October the 15th, which is Pregnancy and Infant Loss Awareness Day, within the week and the month of Pregnancy and Loss Awareness Month and all the things. And obviously there's a pandemic, and I feel like everyone's experiencing hard times. So it's a lot to like talk about something emotive on top of all of that. So thank you. And it's been really nice getting to know you via the internet and like our brief meeting, I don't know, probably over a year ago. Was it two? I don't even know. Yeah, it could be. It's been really nice to like connect with you online frequently, bear witness to part of your story, and yeah, all of the things. Here we are actually finally having this conversation. So tell us a bit about yourself, Felicity. Like, what was your life before children? Like,
somebody once had a conversation with me, and I thought it was the most apt description. I like to live a full life. So I like to do a lot of things. I've always had that sort of, I'm a bit of an extreme kind of person. I have one side that's maybe very sciencey, and I have one side that's very creative. So before children, even in university, I studied biochemistry as a major, and I also did a major in drama. So like that very two different parts of myself.
You're someone who's quite extreme in like, if you like something, you love it.
Absolutely. I'm passionate. I'm super passionate. Yeah. I want to not so much. I mean, I'll support you, but you're not going to get me 100%.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've always been that kind of person that's had that both sides to things. And I'm also a very passionate person. And that comes out in not only my love of doing something and going full force for it, but also in how I kind of emotionally respond to things. Before kids, after theater and science, I landed in becoming a nurse. Mm-hmm. And then when I did my early career stuff, I 100% figured out I wanted to be in pediatrics. And that was kind of where I laid my ground. So I've been a pediatric nurse for almost 12 years now, which has been so great. And then on top of which, on the creative side, I once had an Etsy store selling stuff, creative things I did.
You're a fellow crafter.
Yeah, exactly. So I sew, I knit, I crochet, I make jewelry, like I cross stitch, I do a lot of things. And on top of which, I also started writing novels.
Oh, wow.
Which have been dwindling for the last 2 years or so, because I just feel like the pandemic took the creativity out of us for a bit in some way. But yeah, so those are kind of some of the things that I did before I became a mom. And I was actually married to my husband for almost around eight years. Yeah, before we were married for a while. And I think that was important to us too. We got married very quickly, married exactly 1 year to the day from our first date.
Oh, wow.
So you can see the learning curve was quick after being married. Mm-hmm. And I think we wanted to learn to communicate with each other a little bit better and really feel, not that you can ever really be prepared for kids.
That was your mindset.
Yeah, the better place. And you know, we're pretty open about things. I'm an open book. We went into marriage counseling for a while too, to make sure that we could make ourselves stronger.
What a good way of looking at it. I feel like people see marriage counseling as like a last chance saloon rather than like part of the process of like energy into a relationship and making things work and have longevity.
Absolutely. I think realizing that anytime you do any sort of therapy, about being brave enough to face things, mm-hmm. and then how do you then sort of improve upon the process? Mm-hmm. So, you know, when we have these terrible moments of miscommunication, how can we take that, deconstruct that, see what parts of ourselves need to be improved, and how can we work on maybe not escalating it to the same kind of way? So, yeah. I mean, it was, you know, we still see that counselor periodically, you know, so it's going on like 8 years, you know, off and on. And I think it's a good thing to do tune-ups and realize.
Yeah. I think it's good, like, in every aspect of your life. Like, I'm very much an advocate for, like, don't stop going to therapy when things are great. And don't wait for something terrible to happen to ask for help.
Absolutely.
Like you say, like, you know, maybe we don't need to go so much now, or like we're in a good place, we've got the tools to work, whether it's on yourself or your whatever it is that you're going for. But yeah, I think that needs to be normalized for it to just be part of life rather than to come in at the point of having a breakdown in some way.
Yeah. And it's funny that you say that, because before going to this marriage counselor, I had actually been in counseling myself for almost 5 years. Mm-hmm. When I first met my husband, I went into that in a crisis kind of mode for myself. There was a lot of different pieces of myself that were kind of jumbled up. And that allowed me to continue to advocate for the two of us to do it. And it also helped me understand those parts of myself that I want to instill in my children and maybe do differently with my children.
I don't think you can like fix yourself, but if you don't work on yourself, how can you expect your kids to be these perfect beings, which we all kind of like try and fix ourselves through our children?
Yeah.
Like, I don't want them to eat this bad food. I do it, you know, like,
yeah,
but you don't model it. And I think for me, I'm in this phase of life where I'm like, it's important to me that they're, I don't know, something as simple as like that they're kind and that they don't shout. But then when I get mad, I shout. Like, do you know what I mean? Like, it's really hard to do.
Yeah, it's really hard. I think part of it is that also realizing that our counselor used to talk a lot about how great this story will be.
Yes.
Well, you don't have to tell them that you had it all together. You don't have to tell them that you were perfect. But what you can do is show them resiliency. You can show them that you worked hard for it. Mm. And that makes it all the better. We'll probably get into it, but talking about things in today and the loss of things, I went into that mental health crisis and it's hard to reconcile the fact that my daughter saw that. But at the same time, she's also seen the change that I've done and she's seen the progress. So I can show her the resiliency.
Yeah, that's okay. Like, you can cry. Like, this is time for you to tell your story in however way it comes out. So don't be afraid for that.
I'm not afraid of emotion. It's just sometimes.
Oh, no. Sometimes it just comes out though. Like, you know, sometimes when someone's asking you something, you're like, are you okay? And you're like, I'm actually fine. But you asking me made me burst into tears. And now I'm like, oh no. Like, so yeah, I can understand that. Don't rush yourself. But maybe it's a good place to start in your story. Like, tell us how, seeing as it is pregnancy and infant loss awareness day, tell us how that's affected you.
So Isla is six now and she's my first, and we got pregnant so quickly, like probably one first try. And it was not surprising, but it was exciting. And I had a lovely pregnancy and nothing went wrong.
A fairy tale experience almost.
Yeah. And I had an excellent midwife. The only sort of not fairy tale part is that she decided she didn't want to come out. So what actually had happened is that my midwife went off call on the Friday with the plan to do a stretch and sweep. On the Sunday when she came back on call, and on the Friday I went to go check and make sure that I was all okay in there, because Isla was at this point a week overdue. I had very little to no amniotic fluid left.
Wow.
So that meant a very quick trip to the hospital. And then because I was no longer a simple birth, I had to do a handover of care. And then this is where the understanding of being a nurse, I think, helped me a lot. When you're in a moment and you know you can't stop it, you just have to ride it out. And as soon as I got to the hospital, knew I was going to go for a C-section. Mm-hmm. And I remember looking at my midwife, like the secondary midwife, and just saying, I'll see you on the other side. As if we had an understanding, like, we'll see you in the morning. We'll hand back over care. It'll be fine.
Yeah.
So the process was actually all very quick. And I let Marty know that it's going to be a wait. And then when it happens, it's going to go quickly. So they put my epidural in. They couldn't even up titrate Pitocin to see if I could give her birth vaginally because it was showing a non-reassuring heart rate. We ended up in the emergency room and I have the best photo of her crying as she's coming out of my belly. And it's lovely, and it was a lovely experience, and the recovery was different, but it was good. Breastfeeding was a bit of a challenge, but it was good. And you know, I had such a wonderful experience. I loved becoming a mom, and then the things were a little rockier after that.
Yeah.
So with Isla, we had always intended to wait a little bit of time before trying to get pregnant. I wanted just to, you know, have Isla around. So when she was around two, we decided to try again, and it took a little bit of time, but I ended up becoming pregnant in December of, oh my gosh, now I have to think about this. I want to say 2013, summer around. No. Oh my gosh. No.
Isn't it so hard to remember dates now?
Oh, long and short of it, the December after Isla was two. So 2016. There you go. Got there.
Bless you.
So I was pregnant in December. And then that baby would have been due in September of 2017. And yeah, everything was fine. Because I'd had such a smooth pregnancy with Isla, I chose not to do a first ultrasound. We were doing well. I got my same midwife back pretty much immediately. Everything was good. Everything was good.
Yeah.
Where you sit and you think everything's fine. But it's also interesting because it was good, but yet I don't know. I had this little bit of feeling of slightly disconnected.
Yeah.
And it's a weird thing to explain to people is that I remember going in and just around the time that I found out that I was pregnant, telling my manager, I'm pregnant. I'm 6 weeks pregnant, but I'll keep you posted. And that just came off the cuff, which is very strange. Like, why would I say that? But I don't know. I have no idea.
It almost just came out like a gut reaction.
Exactly. And so who knows? Who knows? And then everything, you know, felt was fine. I was due. So it was the Sunday night of the long weekend. It was a long weekend. Mm-hmm. And I was working a night shift. And I was due to go for my first ultrasound, like the 12-week ultrasound on the Friday. And I remember being on the night shift, and it wasn't a particularly stressful night shift, but I was cramping a little bit. And with the second pregnancy, I'd had a lot more nausea. I had a lot more mood swings. I just really was having a trouble eating, and I just felt grumpy. And after that night shift, I remember coming home, and because it was a long weekend, Marty and Isla were home, and I was planning to sleep. And then I got home and I ended up going to the bathroom and I wiped myself, as one does.
No, but it is something that creates a lot of anxiety, I think, when you are when you are pregnant, because you're almost like checking every wipe, to be quite frank, for something that's red.
Especially after a loss.
Oh, yeah.
And it was a slight amount of brown. Mm-hmm. And okay, I was like, okay. Well, that could be spotting. So I called the midwife and she said, okay, call in sick for tonight because I was supposed to go back. Don't go to your next shift. Just take the day, go to sleep, you know, see how it goes. And I said to myself, okay, I'll go to sleep for a chunk of time and I'll see how I feel when I wake up. And so I think I slept from like 8:30 in the morning till about 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And when I woke up, the brown still hadn't gone away and it was still a little bit more. And Isla was napping because she was still young at this point. Marty was here and I just felt like I needed to go get checked out. Mm-hmm. So I called one of my good girlfriends and she came with me. And she's also a nurse and she happened to work at St. Mike's. And so she came with me and we end up in St. Mike's. And of course they do blood work and they check your betas and you do an ultrasound and she was going to push for me to help get an ultrasound because she knew the doc.
Welcome to have a friend with you though in that who like understands the process and everything.
It was really great that way. What was kind of funny and a little bit ironic is that she had to go to the bathroom.
Yeah.
So when the doc finally came to see me, she wasn't in the room to help.
Oh, nice.
The ultrasound. But that being said, he gave us reassuring. He's like, even if there's bleeding, it's okay. It can still be okay. We'll book you in for an ultrasound tomorrow. We'll see how it goes. We can check your beta again tomorrow. And I was like, okay. And I remember him moving us to a different room just because I didn't need to be in the exam room anymore to wait for the results of the beta. And I said, I need to go pee. So I go to pee and I just go, gosh.
Oh.
Just frank blood.
Yeah.
And at that point, I know. And I remember walking out and looking at my friend Shira, and thank God she worked there. I said, Shira, I need a pad. And she said, okay. And she knew where to go in the emergency room. And she grabbed me what I needed. And he came in the room. The doctor came back like 5 minutes later. And he said, you know, everything that's okay. It's on the low side of normal, but it's okay. And I said, well, actually, I think I have my answer. I just started bleeding. And he said, well, take heart. You know, you can still end up with frank red blood bleeding and still be okay. But in my heart, I already knew. And then,
and you kind of in that moment don't want to hold out too much hope because it almost feels like to go against the things you're seeing that are reality is almost like torture as well.
Yeah. And in the end, like there's that part of me that's, you know, I work a lot with very sick kids. They don't always survive. I'm a strong advocate for good death for kids and for being okay with it. Yeah. I work on my end of life care team within my unit. I was a little bit okay with the process. So you know what? I don't know how to explain that. I was like, if it's happening, I'm not going to fight it because there's nothing I can do about it.
I mean, maybe I'm putting your words in your mouth here, but did you kind of know that you could make that experience the best it could be because of how you treat your patients, or did that not translate because you're feeling pain?
It did and it didn't. It meant I could deal with the process of what's happening right now and I can be okay with it. I actually had overconfidence in how okay I was. Right. But in that moment, I was okay.
Right.
And I just kind of was like, this is what's happening. And I remember us taking my stuff and as Shira, who had driven me, as we were walking out of the hospital, I'm sure this is you're going to know this feeling, and anybody who's gone through this, you feel the release. And I felt the release. And we walked down the road to her car, and I knew at that point, like it was
happening or happened.
It was definitely happening. Mm-hmm. She drove me home. We had a good hug. And then at that point, I kind of had already called my husband to let him know, you know, Isla knew I was pregnant as well. And he kind of prepped her as I walked in the house. And first thing she said was, Mommy, I'm sorry the baby died.
Oh, my goodness.
And you know what? There was nothing we could do but be honest with her. And I know Mommy said too. And it's okay to be sad because it's okay to cry. And I sat with them for a bit and then the cramps started. The horrible, horrible cramps. Went to the bathroom to change the pad. And then little fig as I call the baby. I passed basically the egg sac in the bathroom here.
Oh my goodness.
And in true nurse fashion, true funny nurse fashion, I happen to have, you know, nitrile gloves around.
Yeah.
So I actually scooped with the glove on, I scooped the baby out. And
you have comfort in doing that. Like,
yeah, because what I said, Marty was sitting right next to me and I scooped the baby out, not from like morbid curiosity, but I wanted to say goodbye. And so we scooped it out and I, in my hand, and then I put it back in the toilet and I flushed it. Mm-hmm. That sounds horrible, but.
No, I've done the same.
What am I going to do?
No, I know. I've done the same. For me, it happened in a restaurant because I'd been through the process in a hospital and they kept saying, we can't find the egg sac. And I was like, you must have done. And yeah. I just wanted to get out of there. But we decided to treat ourselves to a nice lunch the next day in our favorite restaurant, you know, just to get ourselves up. And yeah, I pretty much went into the toilet past the egg, as you will, and came out kind of like nervous, cry laughing. I was like, I guess this is going to be our favorite restaurant forever, because I just flushed in there. Maybe. And yeah, like it was the same feeling of like, well, what am I actually going to do? I'm in a restaurant. I'm not planning on taking it out and taking it home. And yeah, I didn't feel like I had a choice, and that's just how it was. And, you know, I know lots of people have been in a situation. I follow a woman on Instagram who talks very openly about her story, that she like didn't even tell anyone she had a miscarriage because she was at brunch and didn't want to bother anybody. Mm-hmm. And I just think saying it out loud allows people to accept their own reality in it. And that is just the truth of what happens for people. It's not wrong. It's just what it is. It's hard and it's heartbreaking, and it's very conflicting when you are literally flushing to be like, what do I do? So yeah, I'm sorry you went through that.
Yeah, but I do feel like there was a little bit of peace in that moment, you know. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the other thing, that it's okay to have peace in those moments and still be sad.
Yeah.
You know, I was able, I even said, I picked it up and showed it to my husband. And I said, let's say goodbye.
You need those acts to mentally process things. And I think however that plays out for someone, whether it is doing exactly what you said, or if it is, I don't know, like giving your baby a name, and in my case, mm-hmm. meeting him and having that moment, I think there's so much power in that. We take that for granted, or it's not talked about enough. Because before it happens to you, you just think it's going to be terrible. But I think there is that moment of peace that Absolutely. Has really seen me through to today. And it, like you talking about it, you can so clearly see that that's helped you in some way.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that's where that part of me that has been through other deaths before. I remember the first time I was present for the loss of a patient. Mm-hmm. And how nervous I was. You don't know what it's going to be like, but it was the most wonderful, peaceful moment. And it's difficult because I can't go into obviously all the details for confidentiality reasons, but I can let you know I was not alone. I was with my nurse colleagues, and it just, that sense of peace that everyone talks about was really there. Mm-hmm. So I'm not afraid of the moment of death.
No, I think it's everything before and after. Actually, that's really scary. I was very much afraid of seeing a baby that was mine that was dead. Like the thought of seeing a dead baby was like going to be horrendous. And yes, he did live, and then yes, he did die, and that all played out in front of me. But the actual process, I think that the messaging I'd like to pass on for me, and maybe it's not true of everyone, is that that moment is like something I want to hold on to because it was so peaceful, and it was, you know, you're so present in it. You're not like in that moment thinking of anything else. And no. It almost gets written out of the narrative that moment can be really like peaceful and joyful. And even if it's like an infinite, tiny, tiny moment, and then afterwards you feel terrible because of what's happening, there is something in that. And I think you're right. It's the peace that comes in that moment.
For sure. And I think that oftentimes, as you're saying, like that part of a narrative gets sort of taken out. Just like the idea that, you know, the loss of a kid, you know, that kid is gone. Well, no, that kid's not gone. And you have Phoenix, and you have that story, and you have that moment, and you have those memories, and you can say, I spent time with my son, as small and as brief as his life was. You know, I carry the stories of all the children that I've met with me. I lost my own, but
yeah,
I am so thankful. Mm-hmm. That I get to carry those stories with me.
Yeah. And what, like, I can't think of a nicer person to be working in such a job. Like, I know that you've run into some people I know that obviously same reason for like confidentiality reasons, like I wouldn't name them, but like I have the knowledge to know that you've crossed paths with people I know. And I think it gives me a lot of comfort to know that you was like the middle person in there.
Which is good. And
yeah, a difficult job, but you just speak about it so happily that I think it takes a certain sort of person to do that job is, I guess, what I'm trying to say. So thank you. And then like, how did that play out after? How was you feeling? Like, I mean, obviously you was probably feeling terrible, but how did that play out to then following through to having your son?
So I had everything go wrong that could possibly go wrong.
Really? Wow.
So I had a sore throat the day that I went to the hospital. And I remember going to the family doctor the next day. I'm going to skip over the not pleasant me leaving the emergency room without waiting for them to tell me anything. Cause I was like, look, dude, I don't need you to tell me that I lost my child.
Yeah.
But anyway, I got to my family doctor and she checked in, and I remember it was so kind. It was the person covering my doctor who was on mat leave. And she just looked at me in the most sincere and wonderful way. And she said, what is it that I can do for you today that would make today better? Wow. And I said, you can test me to see if I have strep throat.
Yeah.
And as it turns out, I had strep throat. Yeah, the worst. So I had strep throat, started on antibiotics. Then I couldn't pass all the products based on my ultrasound, so I had to do mesoprostol. Then the mesoprostol still didn't work. I still had product, and I hate that term, but I still had liquid and part of my uterine lining stuck in there. And so the mesoprostol still didn't work. And then I come to almost 2.5, like 10 days later, and I start to, sorry, Frank, nurse, no filter. I started to smell different.
Right.
I'm getting an infection.
But that is one of the first things they tell you, don't they? Like that smell, is it green discharge or like the color change in discharge is the first indication.
Yeah. And because I was a little bit more in tune, I didn't get to the point there was additional discharge, but I knew the smell was wrong. And that's the best I can say. I knew the smell was wrong. I went to the doctor and I said, you need to check. And she's like, I can see the sense. I'll send a swab to make sure it's not something else. But, you know, we need to get you sorted. And she put me on the list to contact one of the other hospitals for a DNC. But unfortunately, it was going to be like another week wait or whatever. And I just remember crying to the lady on the phone and saying, it's been 2 weeks. I need this process to be done. And she was so kind. She said, look, there's another clinic and you'd have to pay, but you could go and you can go there. And I said, okay. And I called that clinic and they said, if you can get here within the next 45 minutes, we can get you in today. I ended up taking a cab just because I knew my husband could meet me. I called him. I said, you need to come meet me. But we got in, and it's a very, you know, interesting thing to say. Like, as you know, basically I was at a Planned Parenthood clinic and they got me in and I got a DNC that day. They basically turned out that there was a piece of product that was stuck in my cervix and that was causing the infection. We got into the clinic. I was done. They were so great. They gave me antibiotics and more antibiotics. So long story short, at this point, I've been on 2 courses of antibiotics. Then I ended up with several yeast infections and blah, blah, blah.
You're quite ill at that point, really, aren't you? And you're just
if I don't laugh, what am I going to do? Cry some more? Eventually, I started feeling better maybe 2.5 months after everything happened, like after sort of the yeast infections had rolled up. And I was like, okay, maybe we can start considering trying 3 months. You know, I don't remember. I think the miscarriage happened in February and it was like April. Got mentally back on the track that we're going to try. And it didn't come easily.
Right.
And it didn't come easily. And I kept in my head thinking, I'm fine. I've had a loss. Yes, I think about my baby every day. I commissioned a ring to represent my baby. I did all the things that I said, I am coping.
Right. Yeah.
Then the emotions of not being able to get pregnant hit.
Yeah. Real kicker, isn't it? For a lot of people.
That's a kicker. And there was just a confluence of so many different things. So I found out my brother-in-law and sister-in-law were due on the same day.
Oh, that's really hard.
That was hard. I found it hard. I also didn't want to put too much emphasis on it because they had experienced a loss.
Yeah, you're kind of all grieving and that's a very hard situation to navigate.
It was difficult to think that I was going to have a new niece or nephew And I remember thinking, I'm so fine. And then one of my colleagues was about to go off on mat leave and she was very heavily pregnant and I couldn't look at her.
Yeah. And don't you think in that like women are judged so harshly, and that I feel like I always felt that people thought I was going to be jealous. But for me, I just think jealousy is such an unkind word to use in this scenario, because for me, I always felt like, one, I didn't really want anyone's pity who was pregnant. And two, it was like, I likened it to having a really bad car crash and coming out like bruised, battered, emotionally drained, everything. And then someone going, I've got a new lovely car. Do you want to come in it? And it's like, no, of course I don't. And that's kind of how I felt. It's like, I'm not jealous of your car. I'm scared, traumatized, sad about my car crash. It's nothing to do with your new car. Like, they're just two different things. But you would never be expected to do that, like, the day after your car crash or the week after your car crash. And I think it's really hard to express that in the moment.
It's hard to process what part of the loss and the trauma, because becoming a mother and feeling like that is a part of who you're supposed to be, when you, that sense of like, did I fail? You second guess yourself. Did I do something wrong? The trauma of the loss and the understanding of grief doesn't work in a linear way. And I think that people always understand that the same. I didn't look at my colleague and think I'm jealous. I looked at her and I said, I'm sad.
Yeah. You're sad for yourself and you're happy for them, but it's, they can coexist, but not really want to meet.
And they can coexist, just like the loss of, you lose a parent or a loved one. You can coexist in the world and you can be okay, but you can also be simultaneously sad they're gone.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And it can be difficult for your learning, your healing journey, to put yourself in a vulnerable and difficult situation, like going back to the car scenario, like wait till you're a bit more healed maybe to get in the fancy car. Like the fancy car, just any car, like, you know.
It's okay to say I need distance.
Yeah.
I had friends who had had loss before, and I don't think I understood that.
No. I think it's very difficult to understand. And I think that's why I think that the sort of societal jealousy aspect of like, oh, it must be hard for you because like you want to be them. And it's like, no, I want to be me, not in this experience. The other person is completely irrelevant to your own feelings, I suppose. It's just hard to put yourself in there in those moments.
For sure. And I think you really hit on a key point about talking about there's a trauma in it. And trauma is something that can trigger for anybody in any different way. And I think that that's where it just comes down, is understanding that it's okay to have triggers, but then how do you then learn how to handle those triggers? And I think now that I'm so far out of things, this is where I thought I was okay, but I wasn't handling the trauma.
Yeah, interesting.
Like, you think you convince yourself you're fine. So then, you know, when you find out that someone else is, you know, pregnant on the same day, that's a trauma. You're triggered. You can't get pregnant. You're putting more pressure on yourself. And then I remember seeing those god awful, the real tipping point for me was seeing those god awful posters that those pro-life
people
have. And
I saw them where they were like big banners like around here.
In my neighborhood, favorite place, my coffee shop, when I used to go to do my writing, to process, you know, it felt like a violation for them to be in my neighborhood. And I am a Christian. I am a person who believes in life. Politically, I'm more pro-choice.
Yeah. But it's your choice to decide that and not have it rammed down your throat. I think that's...
Yeah. And I remember walking straight up, and this is where the passion comes out, straight up. And I said, how dare you? How dare you? You have no idea what those images do. You know that I lost a child and I had to hold something that looked like that in my hand, and I wanted that baby.
Mm-hmm. And I think you're right. It's like the miscarriage part of that. There's no trigger warning on that, as if like it's so black and white. Even if you, whatever you believe and wherever you are on that spectrum of thought,
absolutely.
Like, for me, like, you know, we're all entitled to our own opinion on that.
One, I think it's very hard to have an opinion without being put in those situations to truly want to push your opinion on someone else. And
absolutely, that's the part
that really, that's the inhumane part for me. It's like the consideration that your narrative is more important than anyone else's, and it doesn't trigger up anything else.
I just don't think that it's right for anyone. You know, no one's going to know how they trigger someone's trauma. But
and it's interesting because don't you think, like, aside from pro-choice and everything else, debate, if you like, is that people often want to, they think they know what your triggers are, and they might not actually be the case. And by that I mean, like, people always used to say to me, oh, I'm sorry, like, this person's got a baby. And I was like, I'm actually more triggered by pregnant people. Yeah, and it's just interesting how for people in their own individual situations.
Yeah, for sure. And like, it's that sense of, yeah. Trauma is also weird because I think it takes a while for some people to even name what is the trigger.
Or even figure it out. Like, it can be very, it took me a long time to realize what that originated from. So.
For sure. And that's it. And that moment was a visceral reaction for me.
Yeah. And you probably didn't even think about it.
Yeah. But that for me was the trigger when I began to realize I was traumatized.
Yeah.
And then my mental health kind of went down from there. I found that I was much more moody, finding I was taking it really hard that we couldn't get pregnant. I remember landing in the doctor's office and saying, like, I don't think I'm okay. Do I need to start on meds? Mm-hmm. You know, I haven't gotten pregnant. The funny kicker about it mm-hmm. is that I actually was about 2 weeks pregnant and had no idea.
Wow.
I had no idea at that point. But I remember saying to people, I'm not coping. The things I would do to make myself cope for the difficult losses at work, the things I would do, I didn't want to do any of them. This apathy. I had these mood swings. I had the anger. I couldn't control that. Mm-hmm. And so when I became pregnant, I was happy, but I wasn't.
Get away, maybe.
Yeah, the anxiety then comes on. Every wipe, every time you go to the bathroom, that confounded, stupid, cheap public toilet paper that turns brown the minute.
Oh, you like go crazy looking at that kind of thing.
And then you're like, I was also lucky that I had some other colleagues at work who had experienced loss around the same that time that I did. And I remember saying, like, when do you become okay? Not necessarily ever.
Yeah.
Well, and she was pregnant at the time. And that was kind of one of those things where the short version, I was very excited to be pregnant with Ewan. I was still nauseated, but my mood swings were horrible. The anxiety was horrible. And then the birth of my nephew, which was exciting. I got to meet him that Thanksgiving. I found it hard, but I purposely made myself hold him.
Yeah.
I made myself hold him. And I think that was good.
Yeah.
But it was hard. The day that the baby was due, another friend of mine had let me know that that would be a really difficult day.
Yeah.
And then I had the confluence of that adding up to the death of one of my favorite long, well, it's hard to say favorite. I have many children that I have loved as a patient. One I had a particular connection with is a better way to place it. That child died 10 days after my baby was due, and it just felt like it was a second loss. And nurses don't often, we're not great about talking about certain things. We have a certain amount of PTSD that comes with
seeing that sadness so much.
And there's things we see and we do in those moments when we're trying to save a life that you don't realize also leave a visceral imprint.
Yeah. You're doing a job at the end of the day, but it's like, I can't even imagine doing those things. And although it's your job, it's still something you're experiencing. So
now 2 years out,
mm-hmm.
I guess closer to 3 years, I am so happy. The pleasure of having been there in that moment outweighs the blessings of being so trusted to be in those moments. Mm-hmm. But at the time, it was really hard for me to reconcile it all. I was lucky. My midwife, I trusted her very much, and it was a different midwife, but still lovely. I said, I need to be referred to postpartum depression group.
And good for you for like advocating for yourself. It's hard to do that.
Yeah.
And my sister had gone through postpartum depression, and depression and anxiety unfortunately run in our family. So I knew I was at a high risk for it. So going through the process of being pregnant, having Ewan, which was actually a wonderful experience because I had a vaginal birth after cesarean. Yeah. I did it with a midwife in hospital and everything.
That experience, everything you kind of hoped it would be.
It was everything. There was nothing that went wrong. Like, it was just a wonderful experience. So, like, the pregnancy was terrible. I was in an emotional, mental mess. But the birth itself, the thing that was part of what was driving my anxiety, went so well.
Yeah.
That I feel like that was just how it was supposed to be. Nothing went wrong. I got an epidural. Yeah. I never stopped contracting.
Yeah.
I pushed for maybe an hour. I had a very small tear. Ewan came out. He sucked in some fluid after being born. We needed a little bit of help breathing. But the pediatric resident who came in to do that care was someone I'd worked with.
Oh, so it was all like a nice story. It's almost like goes to show that you can have an amazing birth and like still be really struggling.
Absolutely. And like, so it was an amazing birth. Like, it's funny because that's not the part of my journey that I focus on. I think, oh my gosh, mentally I was a mess. Yeah. But I feel very blessed that the fact that those parts of it, you know, the regular ups and downs of breastfeeding and everything went really well. And in that, I guess it's not a very exciting part of the story in some ways. But then
also I think it is a story that you're going to look back and you talk so joyously, like when you're animating yourself talking right now, which I know no one can see, but I can. It's like you talk with such joy about your birth. So maybe that is great that when all the dust has settled over how you personally were feeling and the trauma you've experienced and working through all that, that you'll just remember that those births as being lovely.
Yeah.
And isn't that nice? The extra trauma from birth to make it exciting.
Exactly. You know? I think it was the win. It was the win that the universe was providing. And I take that as a part of the piece. Granted, obviously there was still more of the journey that went on and still needed to go in therapy and figuring all the triggers out. But I have to say, like, I've been really lucky with having such a crap time.
Yeah.
With the miscarriage and being so sick and then triggering some mental health things for me and the depression and anxiety, that I can say I came out of the process of having my children with an excellent memory.
Yeah.
And I can say that, you know, I never expected to have a son. I thought I was going to have two girls. I came out of the, you know, the ultrasound expecting to have a girl. Turned out it was a boy, not knowing what to do. Mm-hmm. Set in that sort of weird mental health game, so depressed. But then Ewan has become, for me, the most amazing surprise. I love that he's a boy. I love that he's my surprise. I love that he's different and feistier in some ways than his sister, and he's challenging.
I've got one of those.
He's a lot more vocal, but he's also surprised. And that I think that sometimes remembering that when we have things that happen to us that are kind of crappy, mm-hmm. it's not the world out to get us. Is that sometimes it's the rainbow, to mm-hmm. use that imagery if we want to, that's hidden in the darkness mm-hmm. is actually brighter than you could ever imagine.
Yeah, it's like what you are going to get comes out to be more appreciated and part of your story too.
And that it's okay to be surprised by it. And it's okay to not feel like you have control. And a lot of my journey afterwards, coming back from the postpartum anxiety and depression, I talked a lot with my counselor about the fact that anxiety tricks you into feeling you need control.
Yeah, and no one ever has it. Like,
exactly.
No matter how much you think you do.
And that sense of being able to then reconcile that lack of control. And if you think about, you know, part of what I've talked about is that I think in that moment after losing little Fig, I felt like I needed to control.
Mm-hmm.
I felt like I needed to have it and I needed to do it and I needed to be on this and if I didn't, I was failing. Mm-hmm. And those are some of the telltale signs of the anxiety, because people talk a lot about the feeling sad. I never felt sad. I felt angry. Mm-hmm. I felt moody. I felt like I couldn't control everything, and I felt useless and horrible because of it. And I was going down this dark journey. And I think that that's another part of the piece, that it's okay to say you've had those feelings, mm-hmm. but also remember there's a beautiful aspect of letting go and allowing that kind of sense of figuring out a different way to allow what is being given to you.
Kind of experience the joy that comes as well, and not thinking but they can coexist.
Yeah. And, you know, I'm sure when it came to being in that moment of, you know, learning about what was happening with Phoenix and having to make that, you know, you have some control, but you didn't have any control in another way, you know?
Yeah, you really don't. And yeah, no, that's the biggest thing that parenthood has taught me.
Yeah.
The quicker you stop trying to be in control of it, the more you might actually enjoy where you're at.
Exactly. And I think that also realizing to tell our kids that we don't have to be in control and we don't have to act appropriately all the time. As difficult as it is to now, you know, and like I've always taught my children, like, you know, it's impossible to not cry. But I've always said to my daughter, and eventually to my son when he kind of is old enough to understand, I cry, and it's okay to cry when someone dies. It's okay to let that happen. But now I can also say to her, it's okay that mommy wasn't okay. I remember sitting down and having a conversation with her when I was feeling nervous about starting medication, which I'm still on. Yeah. And I remember saying to her, mommy thinks that this medication will help her. Do you think it's a good idea? Okay. And she became a part of the conversation.
Yeah.
And I think allowing our kids to feel like they're partnered in our life journey as well is kind of a wonderful thing to take out of it for me. So I can say that it wasn't great. It wasn't all lovely, but now I know that I have to then, you know, continue to involve my daughter in it, involve my son, let them know there's resiliency in loss.
Yeah, that's an important aspect, I think, the aspect of knowing that you can get through something.
Yeah, and I think that sometimes when we want to, the tendency within society to forget loss or not talk about loss, not name the children that have died.
Yes. Or think it's weird if people do.
I think that does a disservice to who that person is. Like, I mean, I look at people and think, you know, do you stop talking about your grandma when they die?
Yeah, or your mom.
Or your mom.
How long does someone have to live before they become relevant? Does that make sense?
Yeah, and I think that for me is what I find so wonderful about your story and how for me, like when we've connected, I'm here, I will talk about Phoenix with you because I want to hear, and he lived and he was wonderful.
Yeah.
And he's part of your story, and that's great. I think that in that sense for me, I think it's good to have these conversations because we need to get.
I appreciate you for being on the other side of that. Like, you've just triggered the memory of you coming to my house with the wine and being like, you need this. I was like, yes, I do.
Wine and cookies because we just need it sometimes.
Oh, yeah, and cookies. Goodness me. Yeah, you make a mean cookie, that's for sure. So what do you feel like helped you in your sort of worst moments? Like, what got you through that? I mean, you just touched on saying that talking about it's really helped you, but you said in your notes here your aunt really helped, and you know, the things that you said here about what your kids have taught you, like, that was interesting.
Oh yeah, I don't remember exactly. I wrote that on the night shift, so my brain.
Oh, sorry. So you wrote here about your was visiting from South Africa, and that she was just there for you on some of your worst days, and that was like a real, like,
I think the thing that's helped me the most beyond the medication.
Yeah, that's true though, isn't it? Like, it really does help some people. And I think that's an important conversation.
I think the best way to say it, there's so many different things that have helped, so many little incremental things. Medication for me was a big part of that because what it allowed me to do was have more room.
Yeah.
They talked a lot about the window of tolerance. And when you're in a stressful place, your ability to tolerate things and to not be triggered by trauma is so tight that it's very easy to pop out into the triggered areas. Mm-hmm. And the medication gave me a bit more room.
Yeah.
Gave me a bit more perspective. And then because of that perspective, now I can start to see those aspects of what was going right I mean, I was able to get help and access to counseling. Mm-hmm. I was lucky that I got picked to be in a group. And when she saw me and met me, she said, "You're coming for one-on-one counseling." I was lucky enough to have other people in my life who had gone through medication. One of our nurse that I worked with only briefly at the hospital had gone through severe postpartum depression and anxiety and was a strong advocate for medication and what it did for her. She helped me normalize the idea of what I was going through, normalize the side effects that I was going through as I was up titrating the meds and doing that sense of normalization. And then so those things, but then also those things that I talked about, I can now then see in that haze of not doing well, the conversation I had with my daughter about starting medication, that will always be a prize for me. That helps me realize that I could be vulnerable even with her and we could still repair our relationship.
Yeah.
This part is hard. I wrote about my aunt. My aunt lived in South Africa.
Yeah, sorry to bring that up. Sorry.
Oh, it's okay. It's good. Because this is also that part of grief. So my aunt lived in South Africa. And I have, her and I were like linked spiritually.
Yeah, you described her as your kindred spirit.
She absolutely was my kindred spirit. And we would spend time talking on Skype and connecting. And she was so wonderful. Instrumental in just being a person for me beyond, you know, my mother had also experienced a loss. So there were a lot of people who I could talk to. Mm-hmm. My mother and I at times have a bit of a complicated relationship. We're a lot alike, but Pam and I were so much alike in a different way that it was just one of those moments where she ended up wanting to come visit. Mm-hmm. And I was having a really bad day. I was traveling with my kids to go see my family in Kitchener and my aunt was there and I had one of my worst mental health days. I was screaming, I was yelling, I was losing my mind. My sister lost her patience with me because I was just so, I could not connect with the reality. I wanted to run away, run. I didn't want to feed the fucking baby. I didn't want to have to be tied down. I remember screaming and swearing and
just being in a really bad place in pain, emotionally.
And luck of all luck, that was the day that first thing I did was walk in the house. When I finally walked in the house and Pam came and she just hugged me. Everyone else was trying to solve my problem. Pam just hugged me.
Oh my God, the power of a hug.
And not only that, it was a hug, but the hug from her. And I'm so thankful that I had that. So thankful. Because sadly, that was the last time I ever saw her was that trip because she died in the January after.
Wow. What a powerful, I mean, so sad, but what a powerful last memory of her, like that was her last.
That she could be there. Yeah. So these are the things where I can say that knowing that there were still connections from other people out there, even when I wasn't always able to see them. That normalized one that you're not okay.
Yes.
There are things you can do when you're not okay, as tough and as shitty as it feels.
Yeah, and sometimes you don't even want to do them. You just
know
it's hard to I know that'll make me feel better, but I almost don't want to do it because that's the truth of it.
But yeah, the other thing that sticks out in my mind that the frankness of the counselor that I was working with, she was so great. She, you know, it's a humbling experience, but it was also a great one for someone else's voice beyond my family to say, if you are acting the way you are now in front of me, and I was in a particularly anxious moment at home, I'm concerned you won't be able to take care of your kid.
Yeah.
And then I was so fraught with the idea that I need to do this and how dare I feel resentful that it needs to be me, blah, blah, blah. Why am I? And then putting in that perspective that I wasn't getting treatment for me alone. I was getting treatment to do better for my kids, do better for my family. And then it clicked. It was like, yes, I have to do this work if I want to keep my family and I want to keep my children safe and I want to enjoy the children I have. I have to.
And also just to be the version of yourself you want to be. And
exactly.
Right.
Yeah, and sometimes we need to hear those voices tell us that, that an external person. Oh, you have another opinion in there as well. So to kind of like round off our conversation, I like to ask some more like hearted questions on like your motherhood experience. Like what are your like funny memories that stick out or something joyful? I'm just reading here about your Pinterest-worthy cupcakes. It's literally making my mouth water. I'm gonna need a snack after this.
Oh my gosh, that was funny. So because the kids, okay, total fluke. Ewan's birthday is June 26th, and Isla's birthday is June 28th.
Oh, that's nice. That's
4 years apart. And so for Ewan's first birthday, we were gonna, you know, and Isla's her fifth birthday, we did a combined party. And so Ewan just had to go along with the unicorn theme because that's what I want. So I got so excited. I like looked up, like, I wasn't going full Pinterest out there, but I was going for some small inspiration.
Yeah.
And I had made these cupcakes where I had taken the different color frosting and mixed them in a bag and squeezed them on top. Mm-hmm. And then took fondant and I rolled it into like this unicorn shape and all this like sparkly stuff on it. Put them in the basement and it was moist. So the next day I came in to cupcakes that were supposed to have nice, beautiful unicorn horns and they were looking like limp.
Limp hooks.
But it was also so cute because I was like, well, unicorns can have limpness anyway. It's fine.
Oh, bless her.
It's fine. And like, it was just really cute.
It was one of those like, oh, you try so hard and like, not quite. Like, we're almost there.
It was just so sweet because they were like, yeah. And in the end, it wasn't the cupcakes that mattered to them. It was the fun of being with their friends. So it's one of those moments where
you're probably just, like making them, like all those things, like, I always think about crafts. It's about the process, not about being great at them or having any talent in these things. If you had a day without children, what would be like your ideal, no holds barred, enjoyable for you day?
Oh my goodness. There are a few things that I would do, but I think for today, I'm going to say I would love, 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 love to be back with some of my friends who are authors that inspire me to write because my writing has been put aside for so long and I miss it. Yeah. But I have a lot of good friends and they're from all over the world. And if I could get back together with them, maybe in New York City, like the last time we met, and just hang out and talk shop and talk creativity and that sort of like inspired side, I would love it. Yeah. I would just feel like right now that would do me so much good.
I feel like in quarantine, like, pandemic, COVID world, those small pleasures are so huge now. Like,
absolutely.
To meet someone, well, in New York at all, the crowded coffee shop is just so delightful. In fact, the person I chatted to yesterday, her perfect day was, oh yeah, you want to go to New York? Yeah. Her whole day was all based around being in New York, and that just evoked all these like wonderful memories of the city for me. So, oh yeah, good. And with that kind of being said, what are you missing about quarantine? Like, what's the first thing you'll go do if we could imagine a world where this is all over?
If you can imagine that, well, go outside without a mask on for once. I'm a huge advocate of masks. Obviously, I have to wear them at the hospital, but go outside without a mask and like hug someone.
Yeah.
You know, hug someone without feeling it strange.
Or feeling guilty that you're doing it or whatever. Yeah. I think about hugging your aunt, I was like, oh my God, I could do a big hug right now.
Yeah, you know, like hug someone. Like, I mean, we see a little bit of our extended family, but not with the numbers increasing, but like going and having like a good long hug. I think also just, you know,
giving me a hug.
Sitting in a coffee shop.
Yeah. Dineen, I miss.
Yes, exactly. I can still get a latte on the outside if I need to.
Yeah, but it's not quite the same. Like, I don't get me wrong. I love going to coffee shops. I still do. I still get them from outside and all the things. But
it's not the same.
Sitting in there afterwards, even if it's for like 10 minutes, especially with a kid, if they're in the stroller and they just sit still for 10 minutes, you just feel like much comfort in that. I don't know. I miss that.
And especially, just getting that nice coffee that, like, slips over your tongue and just
Maybe I'm going to do that after this. I've got half an hour to kill and that's maybe what I'm going to do. Thank you so much for talking to me today and thank you so much for like expressing such raw emotion and not being afraid to just be so honest. And, you know, I think these stories bear people's soul a bit, and it's a vulnerable situation to put yourself in. So I appreciate it. And I think we can really learn a lot from other people's experience in normalizing mental health and the wide range of what that means.
Sure.
Medication, because I feel like we're always so quick to say, oh, it's fine if you need to do that, but then we give ourselves a hard time. So I think the more we hear about people using it, having positive experiences and
absolutely
it really helping them, that's really, really important.
And I think it's also understanding, like, my friend got to the point where she said she may never go off of it, and I may never either. And that's okay.
Yeah, exactly. Like, not just going on them, staying on them. Yeah, like doing what you need to do to make it okay. Because I think there is that, the point you made about giving yourself a breather to kind of have the therapy and do all the things and like just take a breath almost. But sometimes actually it's more than that, and not putting expectation on it.
It's just not under the pressure and not letting anybody else affect your journey in a negative way if it feels right to you.
Yeah, especially when at the end of the day we're all here just as ourselves, and whilst opinions like helpful in some regard, like you've got to be there with your own mind and your own feelings and just like, yeah, okay, we're done now, are we? Oh my goodness. Yeah. I've had a baby on my lap before, but they were like more newborn-y, and she's quite vocal compared to the boys. So
I love it.
And you're trying to eat my lip gloss. Anyway, it's been a delight talking to you. I'll let you get on with your day, and we'll catch up online soon.
Thank you.
Oh, no, you're just going to give a big smile. Okay, have a good day.
Thanks for listening to Franny & Co. the podcast. If you've enjoyed this episode, please leave me a review. I would love that. Your ratings and reviews help more people like you find this podcast. While you're there, don't forget to subscribe and share this episode with someone you think would love it. If you don't already follow me, please do at Franny & Co. on Instagram or at Care Club with Franny, where you can find out more about me and the latest courses and workshops I am running. Until next time, take care of yourself.